WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom, filling in for Brian, who is off today. And from all of us here, we want to wish a very happy new year to our Jewish listeners. On today's show, we'll hear what's happening with the new New York City council maps. They're being redrawn, but the commission in charge of that process just voted down its own maps. Dennis Wolcott, the chair of the commission, will explain. Plus, what if the abortion pill got a rebrand and was just called a period pill? We'll hear from someone working on this who will explain why she thinks that could offer a compromise in the abortion debate. And lastly, have you joined the ranks of toddler parents and diners who have long enjoyed the early bird dinner specials at 5 p.m.? This hits a little close to home. A New York Times article says you are not alone. We'll take your calls on whether your social life has shifted earlier lately. But first, we'll start the week with some Monday morning politics and a couple of deadlines that are looming in the nation's capital. First, a deadline to fund the government. Congress has until Saturday, October 1st, to pass a spending bill that keeps the government open. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has spent the past week or so hammering out the details, including negotiations with West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who'd like to include some provisions for energy permitting. Not a huge surprise, given his ties to the energy sector in his home state. We'll hear more about that proposed provision and whether it can get enough support to pass a 60-vote threshold in the Senate. And the other deadline is, of course, the midterms. We don't know yet what Congress will look like next year, but we do know that it'll look very different, particularly for the January 6th committee, which lost its only two Republican members, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, to primary challengers. Not only that, but if Republicans retake the House, it could spell the end of the committee's legal authorities to issue subpoenas, among other things. So that's not a certain deadline, right? But because Democrats could control the House, we're just not sure yet. So what do they do in the meantime? The first hearing since the summer is scheduled for this Wednesday at 1 in the afternoon. We'll hear what they have in store for that hearing and for the remainder of the current congressional term. Plus, we'll get an update on some of those midterm races and what the polling says about what Congress could look like next year and some other topics for this Monday morning politics conversation. Joining me now to cover all of that is Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today and the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, and the Lessons of Power. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Bridget, it's great to be with you.
And listeners, we can take your Monday morning politics questions for Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Anything on the midterms, the spending bill in the Senate, the January 6th committee hearings that resume this week, or any other questions for Susan Page, the number 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can tweet your questions at Brian Lehrer. Okay, Susan, we got a lot to cover here. So let's dive in first with that spending bill. One of those deadlines that I mentioned is October 1st, the deadline for Congress to fund the government. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, along with the caucus of Senate Democrats, have been working out some deal they plan to unveil tomorrow and vote on tomorrow night after sundown because of the Jewish holiday. Can you tell us about the main sticking points Democrats have been haggling over the last few days and weeks?
Yes, Bridget. Well, we've been here before, right? The fiscal cliff that we are always seem to be standing on the edge of. As you said, the government runs out of money on Saturday. But actually, I think that legislative leaders on both sides are pretty optimistic that they have a deal that will pass, that will fund the government until mid-December, that will include aid for Ukraine, some money for Jackson, Mississippi. Of course, they've been struggling with water problems, or money to resettle Afghan refugees. What we don't know whether it will include is that provision that you mentioned from Joe Manchin on energy permitting. He has interest in making energy permitting an easier process. He especially has in mind a gas, natural gas pipeline that runs through West Virginia, the Mountain Valley Pipeline. He got a promise from Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, that it'd be included on a must-vote provision like the continuing resolution. And Schumer says he's going to follow through on that, but there's every expectation that if it falls short, if the Manchin proposal cannot get the 60 votes to overcome a filibuster, that Schumer will ditch it and they'll just go ahead and pass the other elements of this spending bill.
Hmm. And it seems like West Virginia Democrat Senator Joe Manchin comes up in a lot of these conversations when there is a close vote. And you mentioned his particular interest in some of the energy provisions because of the projects in his state. But can you talk a little bit about his ties to the energy sector?
Yes. Well, of course, he financially benefits from the energy sector in West Virginia. So does his family. It's also a big part of the West Virginia economy and even of the West Virginia culture. So it is not new that he is standing up for fossil fuel, for coal, for those kinds of energy provisions. And it's something that's put him at odds with much of the rest of the Democratic caucus. But because the Senate has, as we all know, only 50 Democrats, has given him enormous power in pushing through some provisions that he's interested in. Now, he was also a crucial element in getting through that big bill, the successor to the Build Back Better bill, which included the biggest climate change provisions in U.S. history. So Democrats give him some credit for that. But he has often been an outlier on these issues when it comes to energy in the Democratic Party.
So if this provision that he's pushing does fail, are there any other procedural hurdles that this spending bill will have to overcome before it's passed?
There are always procedural hurdles when you're talking about Congress. And that's one reason that Cindy Hoyer, the House Democratic Majority Leader, has warned members they may not get out on time on Friday. The Democrats members of Congress in both parties hope that Friday will be their last day so they can go home and campaign, those who are running for re-election. So, yes, they've built in some time. They are prepared to stay through the weekend if they need to. But it is, you know, sometimes we get to this point and it's hard to see how they're going to pull a rabbit out of a hat and get the funding bill through. And this time looks, knock on wood for the federal government, looks like a path that is not entirely smooth, but where you can kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Hmm. So if things don't go as planned for Schumer in the Senate, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said she'll lean on something called same-day authority in order to move a House version of the spending bill. Can you tell us what that looks like and what would that mean in terms of making that October 1st deadline?
You know, that's a great question, Bridget, and I'm not sure what the answer is. Do you know?
I don't know. So you and
I'm sorry. One thing I'll say, just I don't know about same day authority and how it would work in this case. I will say that House rules give the Speaker of the House a lot of power that nobody in the Senate holds. The Senate is much more a body where the minority party holds some power. We see House leaders have things like the magic minute, where if Nancy Pelosi stands up and starts to speak for one, no one can stop her until she stops. You may remember she filibustered on an immigration proposal a couple years ago, much to the annoyance of Republicans. And I assume same day authority is something like that, but I don't actually know.
Well, I didn't mean to give you a pop question. Our very helpful producers gave it to me, so we will when we find out the answer, I'll share it so that we both are a little bit smarter on that particular issue. But in terms
of what I assume, Bridget, I know that you have such a smart audience, and I bet people on Twitter are already informing us about what same day authority is. And so I look forward to being educated about it.
You and me both, Susan. Let's talk for a minute about the fear of a government shutdown. You know, it always, as you mentioned, it seems to loom in these situations. I think you know the pulse of Washington. How realistic is it this time? And are there other potential outcomes here that could stay something like that?
Yeah, I think it is likely that they will get some kind of funding bill through by Saturday, by October 1st. They're reasonably optimistic that they're going to get a real appropriations bill through in the middle of December, which means that you're not doing this kind of step-by-step governing funding by continuing resolution. So there are lots of conflicts in Washington where you don't see any resolution. You know, you think about immigration, for instance, that seems to defy any resolution on the horizon. But this is not a case where this is not the worst fiscal situation that we've seen. People are, you know, I think a lot of members of Congress are pretty focused not on this funding bill that they expect to get through. They're very focused on November 8th and the midterm election and what that will mean for all of them looking at next year.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, I'm Bridget Bergen, filling in for Brian on the Brian Lehr Show today. And we're talking with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. And this is our Monday morning politics conversation. We're going to cover a whole lot of ground. If you have a question about the midterms, the spending bill, the January 6th committee hearings that resume this week, or something else, you can throw us a pop question at us. We'll do our best. Call Susan Page and I. The number's 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or tweet your questions at Brian Lehr. Susan, I want to just take one moment to talk about some troubling international developments in the view from Washington. After suffering a major setback in Ukraine, Vladimir Putin has drafted huge numbers of Russian reservists into military service. He's also alluded to the possibility of deploying tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. We've heard those rumblings before. How seriously is the Biden administration, the Pentagon, State Department viewing these threats? What is the feel in Washington as, you know, Putin's rhetoric escalates?
Well, officials are hoping this is a bluff, but they are not assuming that that's the case. And we actually saw Secretary of State Tony Blinken on 60 Minutes yesterday saying that if Putin decides to use nuclear weapons, he said there is no one in Russia who will be able to stop him. And we also saw the administration sent out Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, to be on three of the Sunday shows yesterday with this message, a message designed for an audience of one, designed for an audience of Vladimir Putin, saying there will be disastrous consequences for the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Jake Sullivan didn't spell out what those consequences would be, but clearly they're trying to send a message that to Putin to not take this step.
It's definitely a chilling moment in this conversation. Let's switch gears a little bit more and talk about these January 6th hearings planned to resume this Wednesday at 1 p.m. They haven't officially announced what they're going to cover, but the chair, Congressmember Benny Thompson, has said that there's still a lot of as yet unreleased evidence. What's your sense of what there is still to cover?
So this was pretty tantalizing. Benny Thompson saying there's footage that we haven't seen. There is witness testimony we haven't heard. These hearings have been so compelling. They've been so newsmaking in every one of them that we're looking forward to what happens at this hearing. It's the last hearing they'll have before the election. We saw Adam Schiff, who's been a leader on this committee, saying that some of this hearing on Wednesday will be thematic, that is, trying to pull together what they've learned from their investigation We don't know what witnesses we may hear from or what footage we may see on Wednesday, but the committee is coming to a kind of conclusion, not necessarily because they think all their work is done, but because their authority is about to expire. Every possibility that their charter will not be renewed in the new Congress. So whatever they're going to tell us, whatever they're going to discover and unveil, they need to do quickly.
And I think you're sort of alluding to this already, but in part, certainly control of Congress is at stake. And certainly those two Republicans who sit on the committee both lost their primaries and will not be there when the new Congress resumes next year. What do you have a sense of what this committee, and you know, is that all but certain that this committee will no longer exist if Republicans take control?
Well, I think if Republicans take control, there is no possibility this committee will continue to exist, because Republican leadership took a hard line against it, refused to participate. There were some second thoughts about the wisdom of doing that, but that's the stance that they took. And the committee now faces I think if you're looking at the biggest questions the committee now faces, it is whether they will make a criminal referral to the Justice Department urging the prosecution of former President Trump for his actions in trying to overthrow the 2020 election. And we know this has been something that has divided the committee. Benny Thompson, the chairman, said in June that there would not be a criminal referral, and several members of the committee then push back on that. And Adam Schiff this weekend said that if they make a criminal referral, it will be unanimous, that they would not, as a divided committee, make a criminal referral. That might indicate that they will not make a criminal referral because of the stance that Benny Thompson took. He seemed to think that was not a wise thing to do. But we don't know. And what a step that would be if a congressional committee recommended criminal prosecution of a former president. That would be something we've just never seen before in our history.
Well, we're going to have to take a short break. This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Bridget Bergen filling in for Brian. When we come back, we're going to take some of your calls. We're talking with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. We have more to talk about in the January 6th committee hearings and so much more to cover. Stay with us. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom, filling in for Brian Lehrer, who's off today. I'm speaking with Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today and the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. And listeners, we want to take your Monday morning politics questions for Susan Page. Anything on the midterms, the spending bill, the January 6th committee hearings that resume this week. The number is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can tweet your questions at Brian Lehrer. Let's go to Jim in Brick, New Jersey. Jim, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thank you. And I'd like to compliment Ms. Page on her book on Pelosi. I read it.
Well,
very
thank
nice.
You. Thank you very much, Jim. Yeah.
No, but my question is in regard to Liz Cheney. The Dems have been doing some ads, actually, elsewhere, but aren't there enough Democrats in Wyoming who could do a crossover and support her?
Susan, what do you think?
Well, Jim, you know, they tried that in the Republican primary. They encouraged Democrats to change their registration vote in the Republican primary to help out Liz Cheney, and some did, but there are just not very many Democrats in Wyoming. If you go outside of Jackson Hole, you find that is a very scarce breed indeed. So, no, I think Wyoming was the state that went most soft for Donald Trump of any of the 50 states in 2020. So tough terrain there for Liz Cheney to be challenging Donald Trump. That said, Liz Cheney's political career is not necessarily over. And I think we're all, you know, she's emerged as a hero to some Democrats, although she is in every way except confronting Trump, a conservative Republican. She's a hero to some Republicans who have been uncomfortable with Donald Trump's leadership and his rhetoric. So we may not have heard the last of Liz Cheney, but I think a political future for her is likely not going to be based in Wyoming.
Jim, thanks so much for your call. Call us again. Susan, let's talk a little bit about the former president. Certainly, we know these January 6th investigations are drumming up, you know, more documents that could be part of a criminal referral, but that's not the only investigation going on. There's the Justice Department's investigation into the classified documents he brought to Mar-a-Lago after leaving the White House. And then there's this newly announced lawsuit against the Trump Organization from New York Attorney General Tish James. And yet the former president's out there doing rallies again. He's reportedly been inching closer to outright embracing QAnon conspiracy theories and whipping up outrage. It's kind of a throwback, actually. What does it mean that he can be out there spreading this potentially dangerous misinformation amid all of these efforts to hold him accountable?
You know, it's amazing. First of all, he's got so many legal challenges that you really need a scorecard to keep track of them. There are about a half a dozen separate legal actions that he is facing and has had to defend himself against. And yet, as you said, he continues to be the face of the Republican Party. He continues to be the most dominant figure in the GOP. He has redefined the Republican Party in his image. That's one reason people like Liz Cheney are no longer welcome in the GOP. And this movement to more openly embrace QAnon is something that has been pretty chilling. I don't know if you saw the footage of the last rally he did where they played a song that is like a song that represents the QAnon movement. And then many people in the audience pointed one finger up in the air, their index finger up in the air, which is a QAnon sign. I had to actually Google it when I saw the audience doing that. I didn't know what it meant. So QAnon, of course, a really bizarre conspiracy theory about our politics. The idea that the leading figure in one of our two major parties is embracing it, retweeting a picture of himself, a mocked-up picture of himself with a Q on his lapel, is just pretty jaw-dropping.
Agreed. And that brings us back to some of the other investigations and who will be the audience for some of the work of the January 6th committee. I saw that committee member Zoe Lofgren of California explained that the reason Wednesday's hearing would be at 1 p.m. is in part because Fox News won't carry the hearings if they're in primetime. But so far, they have carried the hearings when they are midday. Why do you think it's important? And I think everything we just talked about before probably speaks to that. But why is it so important that the committee reach Fox's audience?
Well, that is the core of the communications vehicle for many conservatives, for many Republicans, for many Trump supporters, and for many of those who have doubts about the legitimacy of the 2020 election. So, no more important group to at least hear what the committee is finding out about what went on. I think that is a really smart move by the committee because, you know, the committee can't overturn the election. They can't convince everyone involved, can't stop Donald Trump from running again. But the committee can inform Americans about what went on, and especially Americans who have doubts about whether there was fraud, which there was not. There was not widespread fraud in the election. Or Americans who have doubts about whether there was really violence on January 6th, or was it just a political protest that went a little sour? Clearly, it was a really violent assault, an insurrection, an attack on the Capitol. That is, I think, the greatest value of the January 6th committee. And the fact that they are making an effort to reach Fox viewers makes all the sense in the world.
And just last question on this topic. One of the committee's tasks has been to come up with recommendations for making sure a January 6th style insurrection isn't possible going forward. Are the recommendations that they've issued so far any?
Well, we know that there's a lot of support for the Electoral Reform Act, which would make it clear that the vice president cannot overturn the results the way that Donald Trump encouraged his vice president, Mike Pence, to do on January 6th. Now, Pence refused to do that, but the law as now drafted doesn't make it entirely clear what the authority of the vice president is. So this is a proposal that has bipartisan support. It looks like it's going to have filibuster-proof support in the U.S. Senate. So that is one important piece of legislation that has a good chance of being enacted.
Let's shift gears again, spend a couple minutes talking about the midterms. I'm curious what races you're watching and treating as bellwethers for the midterms and how they might change the shape of Congress overall.
Well, there's, you know, we're looking at the House and the Senate, right? It's going to be a tough, it'd be historic for the Democrats to hold control of the House, but the control of the Senate is really up for grabs. 50-50 Senate now. You've got a series that Democrats, that Republicans at one point 6 months ago thought they were going to win a majority in the Senate. They're no longer sure. Democrats aren't really sure they're going to hold a majority, but they think there's a good chance they can. And the races we're watching there would be Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, maybe especially Pennsylvania, which is the Democrats' best hope to pick up a Republican seat. That's been a really interesting race between Dr. Oz and John Fetterman, and pretty close to home for you in
absolutely
New York.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the more interesting and, you know, at times quite entertaining races to watch in our region. It's the Brian.
Well, neither one of them.
Go ahead.
Neither one of them are really typical politicians, really. Really, I mean, Dr. Oz, you know, is a kind of a TV celebrity, and John Fetterman, who wears a hoodie all the time and is talking about his tattoos. So voters have a choice of candidates that are not like the standard issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that is so fascinating about Fetterman is kind of the remaking of the everyman with, you know, as you said, the hoodies and the tattoos and a different idea of who can and should be running for office. It's been very interesting. And certainly someone with an adept team, if not as a candidate himself, with using social media. It's the Brian Lehrer Show in WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom. Also the host of our new Sunday politics show, The People's Guide to Power, live on Sundays at noon. I'm filling in for Brian, who's off today. I'm talking with Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, also the author of a listener-acclaimed book, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, The Lessons of Power. Susan, just in terms of the Biden presidency so far, do you have a sense of how the Biden administration would fare with an opposition Congress? How fundamentally different his presidency would look, you know, if the co-equal legislative branch is just completely explicitly antagonistic to his agenda?
Yes, I think it will be entirely different. And that will be true, especially if both the House and Senate flip to Republicans. But it will be true even if only the House flips to GOP control. You know, the Biden administration has actually gotten through a remarkable number of big pieces of legislation. Sometimes it's been a bumpy ride, but it's really been legislative heavy in significant legislation that has affected the lives of how Americans get health care and about what we're doing about climate change and other things. If Republicans take control of the House, I think passage of big legislation would be very, very difficult. And if Republicans take control of the Senate, it means that could spell trouble for judicial nominations and other confirmations. And the Biden administration has, in fact, managed to get a record number of judges confirmed in these first 2 years. So it'll be a very different world. And this investigative arm of Congress that we've seen demonstrated by the January 6th committee, if that's in Republican hands, they will turn their spotlight on the Biden administration, on Hunter Biden, on the Homeland Security Department, on immigration policies, on a whole different set of issues.
Listeners, we are talking with Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, on the midterms, the spending bill in the Senate, the January 6th committee hearings, all things Washington and beyond. The numbers 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And let's go to Alicia in Queens. Alicia, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Good morning. I was just wondering if any of these Republicans, these moderate Republicans who lost their primaries, thought about doing what Lisa Murkowski did in Alaska and mounting a robust write-in campaign. She won her Senate seat with a write-in campaign. So it gives moderate Republicans an alternative. You know, I know they don't want to vote for a Democrat, but it gives them an alternative. Aside from these QAnon, people that are running for office.
Yeah. Well, Alicia, thanks very much for your call. You know, and Lisa Murkowski won with a write-in, and, you know, she had to get people to spell her name right on the ballot. Like, they wouldn't accept a ballot that said Lisa Murkowski with a letter wrong. So that was an incredible political achievement when she did that in the face of opposition within her own party. But it's a tough road to go. To run as an independent, to run as a write-in, it is a difficult thing to do. Lisa Murkowski had a name that was very familiar to Alaskans. So we have not seen, I'm trying to think if even a single one of these Republicans who have lost have gone that route, and I can't think of one who has. You get the feeling that Republicans who are never Trumpers, who think of themselves as conservative Republicans but disagree with following former President Trump, you get the feeling that some of them want to go third party, form a third party. Some of them are hoping that this will pass, right? That there'll be a new wave in the Republican Party at some point. Donald Trump will no longer be the leader. Maybe it will return to old principles. It's been a discouraging time to be an anti-Trump Republican, that's for sure.
It's so interesting that you say that, Susan. As I mentioned, I host a Sunday politics show called The People's Guide to Power. And my guest yesterday was Congressman Tom Malinowski from New Jersey, who is in that really competitive race in the 7th Congressional District. He's running against Tom Kane Jr., who is the son of a former governor who was, you know, considered a extremely moderate Republican. And yet... Tom Kane Jr. has fashioned himself more of in the modern wing of the Republican Party, we will say. And so one of the things that Congressman Malinowski was talking about in terms of how he is trying to appeal to those independent and moderate voters is the formation of the Moderate Party, and an effort underway in New Jersey to essentially recruit people who maybe do not feel comfortable voting for a Democrat on the Democratic line, but would want to vote for the candidate who is not the far right candidate on another line. And of course, unfortunately, because fusion voting is not allowed in New Jersey at this point, subject to a lawsuit, that's not going to necessarily help Congressman Malinowski in terms of a ballot line in November. But I think it gets to the appeal that we've heard from a couple callers today, this idea of how to appeal to moderates or maybe Republican voters who are not quite in line with the leaders of the Republican Party by taking away the label of the Democrats and giving them someone to support in another way. It's an interesting parallel that I think we're seeing in other parts of the country.
Yeah, it is, and you do feel in our national polling, we see unprecedented support for another party, for people saying the two major parties do not represent me. A majority of Americans now say they wish there was a third party, although they would have, I think, different ideas about what that third party should stand for. We know it's really hard for a third party to get traction. We've seen a few third party candidates like Ross Perot get some traction, but not actually win the White House. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. Our politics changes over time, and the level of dissatisfaction with our current political system is pretty high.
Well, in our last couple minutes, we've looked ahead to the midterms, so now let's look all the way ahead to 2024, and think about some of the Republicans who seem to be eyeing that presidential field. I think there's this notion that the former president Trump is likely to announce he will run again, though perhaps not until after the midterms, but that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis might challenge him. What do you think is the contrast between these two politicians? And, you know, if you are a MAGA voter, what would distinguish one from the other?
You know, it's so interesting. There's clearly such rivalry between them. And we released a poll last week of Florida, USA Today, Suffolk University poll that showed DeSantis defeating Trump in a hypothetical Republican primary in Florida for 2024, which was a big swing, a 15-point swing from what we found last spring when we asked that question, or last Wow. January when we asked that question early in the year. And Ron DeSantis, is the governor of Florida, is offering this recipe. He's saying, I support Trump policies, including his aggressive stance on immigration, but I don't carry all the baggage that Donald Trump does, all the legal and rhetorical baggage that he does. And that has served him pretty well. It's clear that it looks to me like Trump is going to run again. It is possible that DeSantis will run whether or not Trump does, and that will be an important sign of the party, although it would not change the philosophical, the policy direction of the party, because the two men are pretty close on that. Mm. But it could change the face that Republicans want leading that movement.
So interesting and so much to watch. We're going to have to leave it there for today with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today and author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons on Power. Susan, thank you so much for covering so much ground with us today.
Thank you, Bridget. It was my pleasure.